In our study of the Book of Esther, we've come to chapter 7, which I think is it's the shortest chapter so far. The last chapter only has three verses, but this one is shorter than the ones before. Doesn't mean you'll get out of class early, so don't start putting your books up or anything like that. Esther chapter 7. You'll remember the context that the king and queen have already had one banquet with Haman, and in between those two banquets, Mordecai has been honored and Haman has been humiliated. And the last verse before the one we're going to read, Haman was taken off to the banquet after having been told by his wife and counselors that he was about to fall before the Jews. So Esther chapter 7 verse 1. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom. It shall be done." Then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, "Will he also assault the queen while I am in the house?" As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. Now, in the last chapter, we argued that the real turning point of the story occurred in the king's sleepless night. Haman is on his way down, and Mordecai is being honored by the king. But the basic problem still isn't resolved. And here in this second banquet, Esther reveals to the king what she desires to have from him. So you remember she's prepared him for this. His curiosity should be piqued by now. Three times he says to her, "What is your petition? It shall be granted you," and offers her a request up to half the kingdom. And finally, as she had promised at the first banquet, finally she actually tells him what the request is. Now this is, as one commentator says, a highly charged scene. If you think about it, it could all have been accomplished in a relatively short span of time, maybe 10 or 15 minutes from the beginning to the end. And yet it's amazing what's packed into this charged scene. It's a banquet again, so that ties in with these repeated banquets in the Book of Esther. This time Haman is going to meet his doom while he's dining with the king and queen. So the repetition of the king's offer is, as I said, word for word the same, actually, as the last one, the second offer that he made to her. "What is your petition?" in verse 2. And Esther responds in perfect parallel to that. So she says, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king," but then she says, "Let my life be given me at my petition." So that was the first part of what he said to her. "And my people at my request." So she responds exactly to what he has offered. She gives him a petition and a request. And it's done with a tremendous amount of discretion. And we talked about before the wisdom that had been granted to Esther. Obviously, this is still God's providential working. But Esther knows the sorts of things that will appeal to the king. And she says, and throughout this, she speaks in a very wise and discreet way. First, she appeals to the king based on their relationship. She asks for her life. And so the king, even if he had somewhat lowered in his love for Esther, or at least her attention to her, still has her as his wife and also as the queen. And so there's an argument when she says, "Give me my life," she's saying in effect that not only is your wife being threatened, but royalty is being threatened. But then in a very striking way, she parallels the request for her life with the request for her people. And of course, that's the whole point of the story. It was her people who were threatened. And so she requests that Ahasuerus would give her people at her request. Now, if you don't think about it, you might not realize what just happened in that brief request. She had never identified herself as a Jewess before the people, before the people, but particularly before her husband. And so, in effect, she's saying, "I am identifying myself with my people so much that granting my life is the same as granting my people's life." Now, that's a tremendous transformation from what she had been doing. It's also a risk, in a sense, because Ahasuerus could say, "Wait a second, you never told me about this." Now, she doesn't actually identify who the people are. Actually, just like Haman originally didn't tell Ahasuerus who he wanted exterminated. So she just says, "Give me my people." But it's the way the request is worded, she makes a close identification with herself and her people. And you can see the risk involved, right? What if Ahasuerus says no? Before this point, if Ahasuerus says no, she might be able to think she could hide out in the palace and be spared the extermination. Now, Mordecai said that wouldn't happen. But by making this identification of herself with her people, she's cast her lot entirely with her people. If they fall, I fall. And that's it's a remarkable thing. It's not only the wisdom that God gave her, but the courage to throw her lot in entirely with her people. Now, she, as I said, doesn't really spell out what's going on until verse 3, but when we come to verse 4, she describes what's being happened. And again, you can see the discretion of Esther just in the way it's phrased. It's all in the passive voice. Okay, right? It's a little grammar there. It's, "We have been sold." Not, "You sold us," or "Haman sold us." "We have been sold to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated," and so on. So, she again is inviting him to think through the situation without necessarily identifying who the culprit is. And she refers to being sold, which would go back to the money that Haman originally offered to Mordecai, right? You're gonna lose the revenue. Sorry, Haman offered to Ahasuerus. "You're gonna lose the revenue from these people we exterminate, but I'll put an unreasonably large amount of money in the treasury," he says in effect. And so she says, "We have been sold." And then, strikingly, she repeats word for word what the edict had said: to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If you go back and look at the original description of the edict, that's exactly what it says. Now, she had done her homework, and she had done her homework because Mordecai had done his homework, right? Remember, Mordecai sent her the exact text of the edict earlier. And so she repeats it to him. And presumably, in this context, it would catch Ahasuerus' attention more than it did the first time, because it's my people now that she's talking about. And so she talks about the terrible thing that's going to be happening to them. She then refers to the fact that if they had been sold as slaves, she wouldn't have bothered the king. Okay? Now, in a sense, the whole of the kingdom was slaves of Ahasuerus. Everyone belonged to him. After all, how did she get there anyway? Well, some guy showed up in jackboots and said, "You're coming with me, babe," or whatever they said in Persian back then, and that was it. Okay, so everyone belongs. So sold as slaves, well, you know, just a different territory. It doesn't make that much difference. But she says that I would not have said anything about it if that were the case. So again, she's, but in the last part, okay, I'm trying to figure out the right order to say this. The last part of verse 4 is a little bit obscure. And you may have noticed when I read from the New King James Version that it differed from your translation. It's a little bit difficult to see, but the argument seems to be that the king is going to lose by this transaction. Okay? Now, exactly how the king would lose by the transaction is you can speculate on, and I'll read one comment along those lines that gives us a bigger biblical picture. But the you see again that Esther is appealing to Ahasuerus' instincts. Okay? You come to the emperor, you talk in the emperor's language. Okay, what's good for my kingdom? Well, you don't want to lose your wife, you don't want to lose your queen, and you don't want to lose a bunch of money and the damage to the kingdom that would come by the loss of the Jews. Now, what sort of damage would come to them? Well, as I said, there are a lot of things you could think about, but I think from the larger biblical picture, you can see again and again the terrible judgment that God brings on those who persecute his people. And that's basically the context of Genesis 12 that we talked about from the beginning, right? Those who curse you, I will curse. So she's, in effect, reminding him that a terrible judgment would come on him if they, in fact, carried out this decree. McCree, in his lectures on Esther, brings out this point and applies it in terms of church history in a way that I thought was helpful. He says, how many provinces have been depopulated and impoverished and turned into a wilderness, deprived of arts and manufactures and commerce by the sword of persecution? In Germany, France, and Italy, persecutions have taken place from the disastrous effects of which these countries have not recovered for ages. Now, he was writing in around 1800, certainly it is a remarkable thing to see how terribly countries that have persecuted the church have themselves suffered as a result of it, and with long-term damage. France is my favorite example of that. He mentions others. But here, Esther then, however you want to interpret the last part of verse 4, certainly calling on the king to think about what has been done and to take it to heart. Now, the king responds. It's actually hard to take a break here. The king responds, and part of what's going on here is the fact that it was actually the king who signed the decree. Okay, so the king is angry, but in a sense he should be angry at himself. Let me pause, though, before we go into that and see if you have any comments or questions on what we've talked about so far. Yes, Jeff.
I just find it peculiar that, you know, the king doesn't know where his queen is from, what her people is. Like, well, what did they ever talk about? Oh, where are you from?
Yeah. Yeah. What did you do when you were growing up? Yeah. Yeah. Right. I think that gives you a sense of what this relationship was like, probably. We shouldn't, yeah. Yes?
I have a bit more of an obscure question.
Okay.
The edict mentions being destroyed, killed, and annihilated. Is that correct?
Yeah.
It seems that that language, I'm trying to remember where I heard something similar, and I think, isn't there a monument at Gray Fires describing the persecution of Calvinists as being destroyed, killed, so the 18,000 comes to mind, maybe depopulated or something, but destroyed, killed, and I don't know if it says annihilated or not. Anyone remembers that? I told you it was obscure, but
I don't remember the wording of that.
It seems to resonate in my mind anyway. Some similarity in language between the person, which again strengthens the idea of being God's people.
Right. Yeah. We'll have to look that up. Someone could probably do that on an iPhone right now. But anyway, any other comments? Okay, so the response in verses 5 and following is very striking. So here Esther has poured out her request. She's finally answered the king by telling him what it is she's concerned about, and yet she's never actually identified who the culprit is. Okay? And then the king, of course, asks that question in verse 5, who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? The Hebrew is much less diffuse than that, and one commentator says it sounds like a machine gun fire. I looked at the ESV, seems to have a better sense of that. So maybe, Logan, you got the ESV. Could you read verse 5, the king's response?
Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he? Who has dared to do this?
Okay, so that... Yeah, so that also comes up in verse 6. I'll ask you to read it in verse 6. But that you get the sense that Ahasuerus is taken by anger in response to this. Now, of course, one of the ironies in all this, as I already mentioned, is that it was Ahasuerus who signed the decree. There were really only two people involved in the plot to destroy the Jews, although Ahasuerus didn't know who it was who was going to be destroyed. And so commentators have, in many cases, made a parallel between what Esther's doing here and what Nathan the prophet did when he came before David. So, right, Nathan goes up to David after his adultery and committing adultery and murder, and tells him a story. Story about, you know, the man who lost his lamb and the rich guy who seized it and so on and so on. And, of course, David is just outraged. What a terrible thing, you know. Who would do such a thing? And Nathan's response is, thou art the man. Well, you know, Esther could have said at this point, thou art the man, because he was the ultimate authority. He's ultimately responsible for what's happening. That's not the direction she's heading, but it is worthwhile for us to reflect on how different our own sins look when others commit them, if I could put it that way. So we're outraged sometimes at the things people do, but this is an invitation, I think, for us to consider our own sins and how they look, how outrageous and startling they can look when someone else commits them. The response of Esther is also in this very brief and terse language, and I guess I was actually more thinking of verse 6 in terms of the diffuse translation in the New King James. So, Logan, if you could read verse 6 in the ESV.
And Esther said, a foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen.
Okay, so it's just a foe, an enemy, the wicked Haman. And you can see, understand Haman's response. We'll come to that. But again, you can see the courage of Esther here. She doesn't know what the king is going to say. But she's just called the number two man in the realm wicked and an enemy. Okay? So she has so identified herself with her people that she's willing to identify the enemy, even though he's the king's closest counselor, the second in command, as it were. So Esther then makes this identification, and Haman is, it says in verse 6, terrified before the king and queen. That's quite a reasonable response, since he's just been accused of seeking to lay his hands on the king's wife. And Haman presumably had no idea that Esther was Jewish. This was a very well-kept secret, so this is a great surprise to him, as well as a source of terror. So then the king goes out, and it says explicitly in verse 7 that he's angry. The king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. Now, various people have conjectured what was going on in the king's mind at this point. The king certainly would finally have remembered the decree that he had signed. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Okay. Up to this point, apparently, it wasn't really connecting with him. You know, who would do such a thing? Well, didn't think that maybe he was the one behind it. So The king apparently has realized what had happened and how Haman had tricked him. But the king has a problem because he is thereby identified as the guilty party, or one of the guilty parties, in the first place. In the second place, he realizes there's no way out of this. Right? Because you can't reverse a decree like that without losing face. And so he is so tormented by these thoughts, as well as angry that Haman had tricked him in this way, that he leaves the presence of the king, of the queen, and of Haman. Now, apparently, there were rules of etiquette for the harem, and one of the rules of etiquette for the harem is that you don't stay in the presence of any member of the harem if the king isn't present. Okay, so if the king's not there, you don't hang around with one of his wives. That was one of the rules. Even if there are other people present, you don't go so close to the king. Okay, so Haman's got a problem here. He doesn't want to go out and talk to the king, who'd probably just, you know, kill him right then. He can't run away. That would make him look worse. So he decides to go to the one person who might be able to intercede for him. After all, Ahasuerus seems to be able to change his mind pretty easily, depending on who counsels him. And you see that happen in you can see that happening again and again through the story. I think it's implied in the last part of the chapter. So Haman then goes and pleads before the queen. So it says Haman stood, last of verse 7, Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And then in the last part of verse 8, he's not standing pleading for his life before the queen, but he's fallen across the couch where Esther was. This is so unlikely that one of the later Jewish writings suggested that the angel Gabriel actually gave him a firm shove to push him. Just to sort of seal the deal, like, you know. I don't know. I don't think it's so unlikely. I think Haman was so distraught that he figured he had nothing to lose, probably, in this situation. So he flung himself across the couch where Esther was. Right, that was the way they ate and drank. It wasn't like she went to the sofa or something. That was the way they had their meals. So he falls down before her. Now there's a tremendous irony in all of this, because it was originally. What started the whole edict was the fact that Mordecai wouldn't bow before Haman. And in the end, Haman bows before Mordecai's cousin, Esther. This is exactly what his wife and his counselors had told him would happen. Right? You've begun to fall. You will surely fall before him. And that's exactly what happened. So it's represented physically by his falling down before the queen and pleading for his life. But, you know, I said this before, criticizing Haman is like shooting fish in a barrel. There are lots of things that you could say about the guy that it maybe makes us too easy to forget our own sins when we look at him. But it is remarkable that the fellow had just a couple of days ago, maybe even a few minutes ago, had such a high and secure position, should be given to groveling before the queen like this. And it's a striking evidence of how often persecutors are cowards at heart. And I thought I would read what Matthew Henry says along these lines. How lowly Haman looks when he stands up first and then falls down at Esther's feet to beg she would save his life and take all he had. Those that are most haughty, insolent, and imperious, when they are in power and prosperity, are commonly the most abject and poor-spirited when the wheel turns upon them. Cowards, they say, are most cruel, and then consciousness of their cruelty makes them the more cowardly. So Haman, by falling on the couch, Haman falls on the couch, and then the king returns. And it could be argued that Haman has just solved the king's problem for him. He has another charge that he can lay against Haman, which is assault, or whatever term is used currently in law for this sort of approach to a woman that's unwelcomed. It seems rather unlikely that Haman was about assault at this point, but those are mere trivialities when you're the emperor, right? If you can sign an edict to destroy a whole nation of people, making up a charge when you're angry at something is someone is practically nothing. So he says, well, he also assaulted the queen while I'm in the house, and that was enough. Those who attended him understood what that meant, so they covered his face. Now, this fellow Harbona, who's come up before one of the eunuchs, steps forward. You may have noticed that at the end of chapter 6, it was the eunuchs who came to get Haman, and people have conjectured that Harbona was one of them, or at least that word got back to him from that there were there was this tremendous gallows there. So that's the information that Harbona supplies. I didn't make the conversion last week, but or I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, but the gallows, 50 cubits is 75 feet. Okay, this is pretty high up. This was to be an impressive demonstration of what happens to someone who doesn't honor Haman. Okay. And of course, again, that's the tremendous irony involved. Harbona says, look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him on it. Again, you're the king. You make the decision. That's it. Now, the little twist here that Harbona puts in, that Mordecai spoke good on the king's behalf, is referring to the early part of the story last week, that it was the reading of the account that reminded Ahasuerus, or informed Ahasuerus, that Mordecai had in fact stopped the treachery. Some people have conjectured that this might have added even more to the guilt of Haman and Ahasuerus' eyes, because if you're trying to kill the person who had aided the king, then maybe you were part of that original plot. That you're trying executing revenge, or attempting to, on the one who had stopped the plot. So this would add the maybe trumped up charge of treachery to the charge of assault that the king has already made. In any case, as we've said, the king needs no great amount of evidence. No trial for the people of God in the earlier chapter, no trial for Haman here. Just hang him on it. And so in verse 10, they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's wrath subsided. Now, I want to make some comments and some reflections on the chapter as a whole, but before we cheer too loudly that Haman is dead, we should realize that actually the petition of Esther hasn't been answered, right? She asked the king for her life and her people's life. Executing Haman isn't going to stop that. After all, these couriers have gone all over the kingdom. The day is set. Everyone is ready for this. Okay, so that's the matter of the next chapter, right? But it is still worthwhile reflecting on how quickly the tables are turned. Okay? We've emphasized again and again that the point of the story is God's providence, and it's a special providence directed toward his people. I want to come back to that. But one could hardly think that in such a short span of time, someone with so great a prominence and such favor in the king's eyes could be hanging at the end of the chapter. And yet, that's the power of God. He uses the wisdom of Esther. He has impeccable timing, God does, and he carries about something that we could hardly have expected. Now, there are opportunities to reflect on that later in the book, so I don't think I will come back to it, but the same sort of thing happens, of course, in the case of Christ himself, in the crucifixion on the cross and the triumph over Satan and in his resurrection. But it is a very striking thing that this has happened. One other comment before I read some applications and then think a little bit more about the way Esther treated Haman. You could say that Haman died because of things he wasn't guilty of. Right? He was accused of assault, which he wasn't actually guilty of, and perhaps other things. It's a little bit unclear exactly what the king had in mind. But it is a there were plenty of things Haman was guilty on, and if a trial had been carried out, then he probably would have been convicted on them. But Haman could well have said, this isn't fair, I didn't do it. But that, again, is part of the power of God's providence. Whatever the occasion is, God still works out his will in ways that are often beyond our comprehension. Matthew Henry had some very helpful applications just in reflection on Haman and his fall that I'm just going to read. This is a fairly long quote, but it's Matthew Henry, so it's certainly a lot better than I could say it. He says on verse 10, see here one, he has three points. One, pride brought down. He that expected everyone to do him homage, that's Haman, is now made an ignominious spectacle to the world, and he himself sacrificed to his revenge. God resists the proud, and those whom he resists will find him irresistible. Two, persecution punished. And this is the point I was making earlier in connection with the nations that persecute the church. Persecution punished. Haman was upon many counts a wicked man, but his enmity to God's church was his most provoking crime. And for that, the God to whom vengeance belongs here reckons with him. And though his plot was defeated, gives him according to the wickedness of his endeavors. Mischief returned upon the person himself that contrived it, the wicked snared in the work of his own hands. Haman was justly hanged on the very gallows he had unjustly prepared for Mordecai. If he had not set up that gallows, perhaps the king would not have thought of ordering him to be hanged. But if he rear a gallows for the man whom the king delights to honor, the thought is very natural that he should be ordered to try it himself and see how it fits him, see how he likes it. The enemies of God's church have often been thus taken in their own craftiness. In the morning, Haman was designing himself for the robes and Mordecai for the gallows, but the tables are turned. Mordecai has the crown, Haman the cross. The Lord is known by such judgments. So I missed the third point started with mischief returned upon the person that contrived it. So let me reinforce that point. Very often in the Psalms we sing about the one who dug the pit fell into it. And that occurs in the book of Proverbs and elsewhere. God does take the enemies in his own craftiness, as Paul quotes from the Old Testament in 1 Corinthians. Whether it's the wise debater, or whether it's the hated persecutor, God knows how to take the wicked in their own craftiness. Now, there's one other point that I want to make here, and that, I guess occupy the rest of our time. And I'll have to admit up front, this was something I had never really thought about until I started reading the commentaries. Haman asked Esther to save his life, and Esther didn't show any mercy on him. Is that right? Shouldn't we be merciful? Now, lest you think that's just like a silly question, the Puritan commentator Trapp actually took a fair amount of time to defend what Esther did. And it turns out that some modern commentators think that Esther was actually wicked in doing this, that she should have shown mercy. And that's connected with what we'll be looking at later in the book, which is the fact that that not only is this edict, as it were, well, the edict isn't actually overturned. What happens is instead that God's people are given the right to defend themselves. And there are questions connected with that. Is it really right for God's people to act in that way? And that's an important question for us to think about. And I think often the response, especially of the modern person, is to say, well, you know, there's a lot of injustice in the world, and it has to do with the structures, and we need to change the structures, and the world will be more just. And that tends to think of evil as existing only in the abstract. But actually, in the scriptures, evil is a personal matter. Evil is involved ultimately in Satan himself, who is a personal being, but also in persons who oppose the kingdom. So it's all well and good to say that I'm opposed to evil in the abstract, but what are you going to do when someone wants to wipe out God's people? Are you willing to identify him as that wicked Haman the way Esther did? Are you willing to use whatever means you have to act in opposition to that? In short, again and again, the scriptures show that if God's kingdom is to advance, then Satan's kingdom has to be destroyed. And that's a question that I think it's important for us to wrestle through. What was Esther's position? Why did she act in that way? Esther had a position of influence, right? Remember that what I said was probably the most familiar book in the verse in the book of Esther. Mordecai says, "Perhaps you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." She didn't have maybe authority as the queen, but she certainly had influence, and it was by her influence that Esther accused Haman, and also by her unwillingness to use her influence that Haman was put to death. But we should step back another level from that, from Esther, and remember the whole context of the story in terms of Haman and his background. Haman was an Agagite, remember? Haman was not just opposed to the Jews. Haman was in the line of those who had fought to destroy God's people. God had declared holy war against the Amalekites. And here is the representative of the Amalekites seeking to destroy God's people. If you like, think of the contrast between what Esther did and what Saul did, or better yet, what Saul didn't do. So remember in 1 Samuel 15, Saul was commissioned to go out and destroy the Amalekites, and he didn't do it. He wiped out the people, but he saved the sheep, and he saved the ruler. For what reason, it's not exactly clear. But if you like, Saul showed mercy to Agag. And Esther here refuses to show mercy to Agag. Which one was right? Well, you know from 1 Samuel 15 that Saul was condemned, in fact lost his kingdom. But Samuel, in one of the more graphic scriptures in the Bible, says Samuel hacked Agag to pieces before the Lord. Shouldn't repeat that in public, I suppose. But that was an act of holy war. This was the opposition to God's people that they were commanded to end. They were commanded to destroy the Amalekites. Now, of course, when I say things like that, I hope we all get a little bit nervous. Does that mean that it's right to go up to a church in Wichita and shoot an abortionist? After all, isn't he an opponent of God's people? Does that mean I should have no mercy on the wicked? Well, no. That's a very dangerous conclusion to draw. It's a wicked thing to do something like that. And here's where Esther's calling differs from our own calling. And here's where it's a very bad idea to take Esther as an example, right? Some people are all for taking Esther as the example of courage and so on, but they may not be for taking Esther as the one who puts her fingers in her ears when someone pleads for his life. Esther had a specific calling. God had put her in that place. But we have no calling to go out and shoot abortionists. We have no calling to take the law into our own hands. This is an important point because this comes up a lot in the Psalms. And I'd like for you to turn with me to lots of references we could look at. But let's look at Psalm 58, verse 10. This is one psalm that came to my mind in connection with this question. Because we sing the Psalms, and because the Psalms often call for God to judge his people, it's possible that people could get the wrong idea, as if when I sing a psalm like this, that means that I myself should be a vengeful person. I should take out on my own the wrath that I have against anyone who has offended me. And notice Psalm 58, look at particularly at verses 10 and 11. The righteous shall rejoice when he sees the vengeance. So in the previous verses, the vengeance on the wicked has been described. The righteous shall rejoice when he sees the vengeance. He shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked, so that men will say, surely there is a reward for the righteous. Surely he is God who judges in the earth. Now, the righteous here are not the ones who shed the blood. It's God who judges in the earth and not us. It's God to whom vengeance belongs. And what's even more important is that you can see at the beginning of the chapter, at the beginning of the psalm, that this is about people in places of authority, places of power. So this is about people who judge but don't judge uprightly. In their heart they work wickedness. These opening verses fit Haman pretty well, don't they? And it describes the judgment that God is going to bring upon them. Break their teeth and their mouth, O God. So when the righteous rejoice, it's not a rejoicing because they are an unmerciful people, but because they believe in a righteous God. We said last week when, in connection with the humor in the chapter, that God laughs at the wicked and he invites us to laugh with him. Well, this is a similar thing. God invites us to rejoice when the wicked are judged. And this is the sort of thing you see even in the book of Revelation, that the saints in heaven sing praising God for his justice. But the distinction is that it's not us taking vengeance in our own hands. You ran into my car. You stole from me. I'm going to get you because I'm a righteous person. No. And so it's very important to keep in mind the apparently contrasting but consistent warning. And this is where I'll end. Turn with me to Proverbs 24, verse 17. And this is actually a very good way to close our study, at least as far as it concerns Haman. We say goodbye to Haman, and we should remember these verses when we say goodbye to Haman. Proverbs 24:17. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him. We may have many enemies, but we're not supposed to rejoice when they fall. The contrast between this and Psalm 24 is that those people were enemies of God, and God dispatched them, and we rejoice in the justice of God. The temptation that we're warned against in Proverbs 24:17 and 18 is the temptation to pride and to self-vengeance, and there is a very severe warning about that. If God sees that in you, he will turn away his wrath from him, and the implication is his wrath will come on you instead. So when we look on someone like Haman, we should see ultimately a representative of Satan and his kingdom. And we should rejoice that Satan's kingdom is destroyed, and that even by the hand of one of his saints, Esther, who accused him before the king. Okay, I guess we have lots of long footnotes on Esther, even though it doesn't have a lot of maybe direct theological discussion, there are many questions that it raises. Any comments or questions? Any stones to be cast at me for, you know, encouraging going out and singing those psalms or anything like that? Yes?
Concerning Esther not being merciful, there's also a very big difference in setting between the person who goes into an abortion clinic and tries to blow it up, and Esther is in a judicial situation. She's before the king, the judge, defending, presenting an accusation against a murderer.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So she had a judicial position, and she was faithful in it. So we're not supposed to take the law into our own hands, as it were. Good. Other comments? Okay. Let's close in prayer.